Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Anna DeVlatis now with This Week in Chicago History, and we'll start with the Michael Jordan statue. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Bob. Yeah, so not one, but three actual Michael Jordan anniversaries this week in Chicago history. It's the week he debuted as a Chicago Bull in 84. His 23, number 23 jersey was retired this week. And this week, as you mentioned, the iconic statue of Michael Jordan was unveiled to the public. It was such a cool moment. Go back to November 1st, 1994. Originally positioned outside the United Center, they moved it indoors now, as we know, into the atrium. But it was unveiled during to the public during this star-studded, nationally broadcast tribute to Michael Jordan. Significant event for the city, not only because of this iconic statue that would forever be placed there outside the UC, but it was a moment to just honor Jordan and not only his career, but his impact on the city of Chicago. Recall, Bob, that at that time in 94, everyone believed that this was the end of MJ's pro basketball career. You know, he was retiring. He made that announcement at the end of the 93 Bulls championship win, and it felt real. So here this was, the statue that was engraved with the best there ever was, the best there ever will be. And over the years, millions of people posed with that statue. Of course, we know Jordan came back, but we pulled a clip here that is pretty memorable. And near the end of that nationally televised ceremony, when a newly retired Jordan, for the first time, steps up to the mic and just addresses the public and reflects on his career.
Yeah, pretty cool. And they retired his number 23 jersey then as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they lifted it up to the rafters, and who knew, you know, he'd come on back. So we got to look at it for a lot more championships, a few more, right? So
yeah,
it was pretty
more.
Cool. But
let's talk about Charles Walgreen and what he started around here on the south side first, right?
Such an interesting history, Bob, for this. 124 years ago, Charles Walgreen launched his first store on the South Side, South Cottage Grove, to be exact, 1901. True story, Walgreen had lost part of his finger in a shoe factory accident when he was young, and his doctor said, you know, why don't you become a pharmacy apprentice? It might be interesting for you. And he did. So he got his Illinois pharmacy license in 1897. 4 years later, he bought the store from the guy he was working for on Cottage Grove, and it changed everything. He changed everything. The whole pharmacy business, he just looked at it in a very different way. You know, they had these dimly lit apothecaries at the time, and he turned them into well-lit stores that people wanted to go into. They were community outposts that he emphasized customer service and friendliness. He introduced household goods and gave you other reasons to come in the store. He even introduced soda fountains inside a pharmacy, which was a new thing. Nobody was going in to get a chocolate malt and their pick up their meds, you know, but then he did it. And he had this speedy delivery service and all kinds of new things. So he expanded to 5 stores in 10 years. By 1919, it was 20 stores. Then when Prohibition hit, it was a huge boom for the pharmacy business because alcohol was prohibited except by prescription. It was considered medicinal. So you couldn't go into a tavern legally and get a drink, but you might be able to go to a doctor to write a prescription if you had a certain health condition. So business kind of exploded around that time for all pharmacies. And Charles Walgreen was also a huge believer in advertising. He spent what was considered a princely sum to promote his stores. He took out a full-page ad in the Chicago Tribune, which was unheard of for a pharmacy. He built illuminated billboards. And that's not all, Bob. You'll appreciate this one. Walgreen's historian Mike Weber, a 26-year employee, describes other ways that Walgreen's got public attention.
Well, that's why they were a success. They advertised on WGN.
Exactly. Cubs sponsors, who knew way back in the day that was one of their early, you know, pieces of their success. No question, Bob. No question.
And, they were one of the first of the Chicago brands to go national, weren't they?
They're one of the first Chicago brands among Sears and Montgomery Wards to take their brand national. They were also one of the first to add photo processing, open 24-hour stores, open drive-through pharmacies, in-store clinics, they just kept innovating to stay ahead of the trends. And kind of interesting, if you want to go back, Bob, and look at what the first store looked like, the first Walgreens on the South Side, the Museum of Science and Industry has a replica on display right there, you know, to check out. So something interesting.
Back to this week in 1948 now, and the Chicago Tribune made a now-famous boo-boo, didn't they?
Oh, Bob, this is an interesting one. Like, if you think about it, like, okay, so I hate to even bring this up because the Tribune does great work, but, you know, back then, 1948, this has become a part of journalism history. When they made this boo-boo, they declared that New York Governor Thomas Dewey had won the presidential race, not Truman, and they went to print with over 150,000 copies. The big headline splashed across the front page, Dewey defeats Truman. And if you go back and look at history about how it happened, there were several key factors. First, Dewey was the overwhelming favorite in the race. He was polling so far ahead that some pollsters stopped polling even in September, calling the election. Every editorial board across the country, every political organization of all political stripes believed that Dewey was going to, quote, run away with it. And Truman's approval rating was just 36% at the time, which was really low for someone seeking re-election. And if you think about it, he was the accidental president who took over for FDR, and people just were criticizing him. You know, he's this former farmer. He didn't go to college. He didn't mince words. He came across kind of crude and maybe unknowledgeable, especially in foreign policy issues. So contrasting to that, Dewey was this well-liked, younger, educated, political star, articulate, and a better-funded candidate, too. So every single pollster believed that Dewey would win. But when the East Coast votes came in, it also validated that. So the papers were believing this is what we thought. It's a landslide victory. And the Tribune, you know, just like so many others, didn't count for the undecided voters that broke for Truman. The Midwest, working people, blue-collar, union workers, farmers, all overwhelmingly voted for Truman. A huge undercount that year, and we've seen that. We've seen that in our recent history, mm-hmm. but believing he lost the election. And here is a clip we pulled regarding that.
President Truman, that famous picture of him holding up that headline and smiling.
Right, he was smiling ear to ear. Even he went to bed that night thinking he had lost the election. Yeah. So there you go, Bob.
Yeah, any better. He did go all the way 9 years ago this week, Anna.
Yeah, 9 years ago. So many wonderful memories. That kind of where were you when memory for all Cubs fans remembering November 2nd, 2016, when the Cubs ended that 108-year drought and won the World Series. We pulled some memorable moments here, Bob. See if you remember these.
Seems like just yesterday and also ancient history.
It totally does. Where were you, Bob? It was a away game, so a lot of Cubs fans mm-hmm. weren't lucky enough to go.
I'm watching with my family, and I remember, you know, falling off the couch a number of times during that last game.
It was right. It was a intense game. Game seven, right? 8-7
yep.
was the final score.
And finally, we have what is referred to maybe by you, Anna, as the most dangerous toy in the world. A little Chicago Christmas history.
Okay, this one, see if you think this is as weird as I do. This was actually referred to later by everyone as the world's most dangerous toy, or the toy that the most dangerous toy that the world's ever known. This week, 1950, Bob, Marshall Field's State Street store debuted the Atomic Energy Set just in time for early Christmas shopping. And tell me if you think this is a good idea. The Gilbert U-238 Atomic Energy Lab Kit had three sources of radiation in the kit, four uranium ores that were radioactive, and it came with a pamphlet on how to source uranium as well, plus various tools that enabled you to, like kids, little kiddos, to dig into the world of atomic energy and chemistry. It was marketed as this thrilling educational set for young nuclear scientists. But there were no safety goggles, no protective gear included, no disclaimer about radiation exposure, nothing like that. And the radiation levels, while they weren't lethal, Bob, or immediately harmful, there were certainly long-term studies at the time, maybe not as many, about exposure to radiation. And, you know, it just wasn't, there was no labeling on it, nothing like that. So this was the atomic age, and there was this sort of national pride at that time about getting involved in that area of science. But still not a great idea. I think most of us would say that you would give the little kiddos the radiation therapy thing or the science kit. It didn't last long. Fields pulled it from the shelves. I don't know if it was the $600 price tag in today's dollars or the fear of the DNA damage. I don't know. Or the hair loss. I'm not sure. But it did get pulled, and it did not sell well. But that was an interesting part of Marshall Field's history.
I do remember the name A.C. Gilbert on a lot of these toys.
Yeah, A.C. Gilbert took over. He was an inventor and a former magician, and he took over the toys. And he was somebody who actually had saved Christmas one year, they said, because after during wartime, they had mentioned that the government wanted to halt all toy production. And so they said, you know, we need all the manufacturing lines to be for the war effort. And he actually made a very compelling argument advocating for toys, that kids needed toys. So he was credited as saving Christmas one year. But then he put out this atomic energy kit, Bob, and I think he kind of canceled out all the good he did in the world.
He saved Christmas and radiated the kids in 1950 at Fields. Thanks, Santa. We'll talk to you again next week.